Hello, welcome to Playback Daily. I'm Trevor Keegan, and this is a look back at a cross-section of content from across RTE Radio 1 on Tuesday, the 20th of May, including...
I didn't actually think that we were going to go to Nigeria, and then 2 months later, I was standing in the middle of Lagos, which was great. I had my own bodyguard for the whole time that I was there.
I actually inherited my first two colonies of bees from a friend of mine who passed away.
This is the best start to a season we've seen in a long, long time. It's probably the best ever, I think, I can remember, you know, that we've had a couple of months of really good weather. And of course, it suits the strawberries perfectly.
Yesterday, Donald Trump tried again to be the broker of a possible peace deal in Ukraine. But his phone call with Vladimir Putin seems to have turned into more a case of I said, you said, than actual political diplomacy. Audrey Carvel got the details from the Russia editor of BBC Monitoring on Morning Ireland.
A two-hour phone call between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin yielded very different accounts yesterday. Mr. Putin said his country was ready to work with Ukraine on a memorandum on a possible future agreement. Donald Trump said Russia and Ukraine would immediately start negotiations for a ceasefire. We're joined now by Vitaly Shevchenko, Russia editor with BBC Monitoring and co-presenter of the BBC Ukrainecast podcast. Vitaly, thanks for taking our call and good morning to you. So in Vladimir Putin's recount and recall of the phone call, he had no mention of immediate negotiations, did he?
He didn't. And in fact, he restated Russia's position that what he calls the root causes of the crisis must be addressed. And what that means is basically are the reasons why Russia started this war in the first place. Because there's no acceptance on the Kremlin's part of Ukraine as an independent state. So that is something Vladimir Putin is still very keen to pursue. And what happened yesterday, that phone call, essentially was it was talks for the sake of more talks. No ceasefire, no sanctions, not even a summit meeting between any of the presidents, Putin, Trump, or Zelensky. That's not happening. And Donald Trump, he's even reversed his early insistence that a ceasefire must precede talks. Now he's saying what Vladimir Putin is saying. No, we are going to talk first and then think about a ceasefire later. So from that point of view, I can't say much progress has been made. And given what Vladimir Putin is saying and doing in Ukraine, I really don't see anything to suggest that his appetites are in any way diminished.
So why isn't Donald Trump getting tough with him? He's not talking about sanctions. If anything, after that call yesterday, he spoke about reducing them and putting in enticements for trade and economic development. It appears, at least from this distance, that it is Vladimir Putin, who is really in charge here?
It's a really good question. What Donald Trump has been saying is basically what I imagine Vladimir Putin wants him to say. Sanctions, no, they'll only make things worse. He's threatened to walk away from the whole process, and that's exactly what Vladimir Putin wants him to do, and that would leave Ukraine basically for Russia to take if American aid ends with that as well. So I would argue that Vladimir Putin is emboldened by Donald Trump's actions and words, and also the lack of action on the part of Ukraine's allies, European allies. It's been more than a week since the deadline that they set for Russia to cease fire on Monday, the 12th of May. It came and went, and the threatened crippling sanctions to follow should Russia fail to cease fire. And there's no sign of those crippling sanctions either. So it's basically an invitation for Vladimir Putin to keep on attacking Ukraine.
And despite him saying he would meet President Zelensky, he didn't, of course, last week in Istanbul. Is there any prospect of those talkings, albeit at that much lower level than was promised, are they continuing in any form?
Apparently, some sort of contact has continued. As I understand, Russia and Ukraine have been in touch with each other to flesh out the details of the prison exchange that they agreed in Istanbul last Friday. But frankly, I believe it when it happens. And also, it's not what Ukraine wanted, because it wanted a ceasefire and progress towards more lasting peace. Instead, we have lots of words, lots of talks, while people in Ukraine are being killed.
Do you think you'll see peace in your homeland, Vitaly?
Well, I'm sure it will happen eventually. This can't go on forever. The question is, what sort of peace? Because over the past 3 years, Ukraine and its allies have moved away from talking about victory. And now they're talking about a just peace. And everybody's got their own idea of what just means in this case. And when Donald Trump says he's determined to make it stop, of course, the easiest way for him to make it stop is to stop supplying aid to Ukraine. And without it, Ukraine would find it much more difficult to keep on fighting. And that's one way of stopping it, really.
Dermot Whelan had a busy show filling in for Oliver Callan. His first guest was an Irish woman who is head chef at a Michelin star restaurant in London, who's hoping to stamp out sexism in professional kitchens.
She is head chef at a Michelin starred restaurant called Chishuru. Christine Walsh spends some days on her feet for 15 hours in the high-paced, high-pressure kitchen and has spoken frankly about sexism in the industry. Her Instagram handle is Bogger Chef, and she joins me now. What is on the menu for tonight, or is it something that you think about?
Well, for Chishuru, it's very much I think the food is not usually what a lot of people that I would know would eat, but it's definitely something I would urge people to try. But I suppose for menus, it's very much a collaboration between myself and the owner and exec chef, Jockey Bacare. So everything kind of goes from, I've nothing really to compare it to because it is West African food. I don't really get that much around Killinall. So we talk about things quite a lot. She'll tell me what, basically what it was like for her growing up and the flavours, and then I'll kind of take some of those flavours and we develop things and we come up with some nice dishes. Lots of spice, lots of chilies, scotch bonnets, lots of layering with onions to give sweetness. It's very interesting.
Did you ever think you'd end up with West African food being one of your specialities?
It wasn't even in my orbit. No, I didn't. I wouldn't say it's a speciality, but it's definitely something I'm a lot more knowledgeable about now.
Yeah, we obviously must like a challenge and to be taking on all these new flavours, new skills, all this, I mean, this history and culture embedded in all these meals, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah, I love a challenge, especially where food is concerned. I've always kind of had an interest in anthropology and culture, especially where it revolves around food. So to get an opportunity to work in the middle of a West African restaurant, kind of at the top of its game, is I'm very fortunate to get that opportunity. Yeah.
Did you travel to Nigeria to explore some of these dishes?
Yeah, we did. When, just before I started, I was told that I'd be brought to Nigeria. And you know, when you start jobs, sometimes they'll say, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and you don't really believe it. You kind of, right, this is their selling point. But I didn't actually think that we were going to go to Nigeria. And then 2 months later, I was standing in the middle of Lagos, which was great. I had my own bodyguard for the whole time that I was there. So it was good. Yeah, I loved it. I'd go back in a heartbeat.
Yeah. And did you see any parallels between the Irish and the Nigerians in terms of cooking or family or how they treat food?
there is a connection between, well, obviously, with African nuns and stuff going out there. I've been told a lot about how nuns have gone to different parts of Africa to kind of help out. Mm. And there's a huge Irish influence there. Guinness especially. Nigerians love their Guinness, and as do I. So that was a very emerging topic. But apart from that, like, it's when you get there, it's kind of a sensory overload. You know, you're standing in these markets in 38 degree heat, and it's just full of food and thousands of people. It's quite a lot, but you're trying to take in so much at once. It's hard to compare at that stage because I've never been in those situations before.
Yeah. I love the fact that you can take, you know, food like West African food, and it can be part of a Michelin starred restaurant, to be the focus of the diners and everything that you're creating in the kitchen. I think it's a sign of just one of the benefits of living in a big capital city, that you have this variety and access to food. It would be so much harder to do that in Ireland, I would guess.
I mean, in smaller areas of Ireland, yeah, of course, because there's not a huge variety of, like, thousands of different cultures. But in places like Dublin, Galway, Cork, you definitely have a bit more of a way in to kind of see different foods and different food cultures. But London, yeah, God, it's like a haven for people that are just obsessed with different foods. It's great. It's hard to choose sometimes because there's nearly too much choice.
Yeah, yeah. There's usually a family influence when it comes to things like this. Was it your grandmother who got you into cooking?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say she got me into it. I was kind of welded to her from a very young age. So I would be kind of, I'd have my toe in every pot that she'd have on the cooker. Yeah, she had a massive influence on me deciding that I wanted to be a chef. You know, when I was in like early 90s, my first tastes of like mangoes and avocados and kumquats were in her kitchen in Killinall, which were, I didn't think that was a rare thing, but in hindsight, it really was. She'd go into a supermarket and like the exotic fruit section and pick up these random things. And I used to be so interested watching her just kind of figure it out and delve into them. And it really stuck with me.
Yeah, it's lovely. It just sort of embeds itself there, almost like a computer virus in a good way. Like sometimes we take it on board and then it's not going to emerge for, you know, maybe until years later. Because you didn't go straight into chefing or cooking, did you?
No, I didn't. I went to UCC after school. I had intended on being an English and geography teacher, but to be honest, I don't even think I had that much interest in it. I wanted something more out of just sitting in a lecture hall or just standing in a classroom. I wanted to learn more about people and cultures and food. And I eventually did a course in WIT. And then I realized that I was actually pretty good at this. And so I stuck with it.
Yeah. What did you do in Waterford Castle?
Well, I started my career there. I was a commis chef there. Mm. It was a man by the name of Tony Barry in WIT. I think he must have seen something in me. Great fella. He called me out one day and said, "Right, I'm going to bring you out. I want you to meet somebody." And so the next thing, like, I had never heard of Waterford Castle. I didn't know you had to get on a ferry to get out there. I didn't know what was going on. So the next thing, he drove his car onto a boat, and my mother rang me and, "Where
oh my
are you?"
God, said, "I'm emigrating.
I'm on some boat with my lecturer. I don't know where we're going." She's like, "What? You're on a boat? What?" And then he brought me out, and then he introduced me to this chef, Mick Quinn, and then kind of Mick took me under his wing, and I worked at the castle for, I'd say, nearly 5 years. But I learned, nose to tail was something that we were doing before it even became like a popular thing in kind of current kitchens, you know.
What's nose to tail? Is that on a spit?
Like you get in like a whole animals, and it's whole animal butchery, and you break down the whole thing and utilize the whole animal instead of just getting bits and pieces. It's a far more sustainable way of cooking,
of course,
especially
yeah.
if you're dealing with the farmer directly.
Yeah. Did you ever cook pigs on a spit?
I did, yes, I did. That was part of my job for a while. I thought it was just a regular thing that people did, but apparently it's not. I used to have to get up at like 6 o'clock in the morning, get the ferry over to the castle, figure out how to get this massive pig onto a spit for a wedding for like 80 people that night. So I'd have to like throw it into a black sack and into a wheelbarrow and wheel it out to the front of the castle and try and stick it up in a spit. It's very, very hard labour, I have to say.
Yeah, well, I think people look at it would think, sure, that's, you know, just grab a sweeping brush in one end, out the other, lob it up on the fire and away we go.
Yeah.
But I guess there is a lot more to it. Plus, I mean, the fact that as Irish people, you know, barbecuing one sausage terrifies us that we're going to give ourselves salmonella. Like, you know, I can just imagine the cries of, is it cooked in the middle? Is it cooked in the middle?
Yeah. But I'd have to, you know, I'd have to look after that whole setup for about 10 hours and I'd go home stinking a campfire.
Yeah, I know. It's a bit of an ordeal. But of course, your journey took you to London and actually to other places too. And I'm fascinated with this. You did go on to work in a Michelin star restaurant such as Noma, which is in Copenhagen in Denmark. And there was a nod to this in the series The Bear, if people are fans of that famous award-winning series about chefs in a kitchen. And you worked there and you would imagine that would have to be the pinnacle of your career at that point, that you're going to work in a Michelin star restaurant with some of the most creative and famous people in the world. What was that experience really like?
I mean, I had applied to work at Noma for, I'd say, a week, every week for a couple of years. And now before I went there, I'd also worked in a 3-star in San Francisco called Bennu. So I was familiar to the kind of work and all that. But when I got there, I think maybe it was my own kind of social awkwardness that I felt like I just didn't, I couldn't get the vibe of it. And it was devastating because, you know, the people, it was a nice place. You know, there was nothing sinister about the place. It was, they were really kind of into what they were doing. But I just couldn't, I just feel like I couldn't get a hold of it. And, you know, it happens, you know, some kitchens you go into, like anybody, like any job, sometimes you think you like it and you will like it and then you don't.
Yeah.
But it was really devastating for me. I was devastated that I didn't love it. And I nearly left chefing after that because I thought that I had gotten the best opportunity a chef could get. And I messed it up because I didn't love it. So it was to go back to the drawing board.
Did that highlight something for you, I guess, now as someone, you know, who runs a Michelin star restaurant, you know, when you're the boss?
Yeah.
Did it show you the importance of the team nature, the gelling of the people there, the vibe, for want of a better word?
Yes,
but actually, it's the stuff in and around the chefing and the meal preparation and the men dreaming up menus that actually it's the less tangible stuff that maybe has a lot more importance than we realize.
Yes. Very much so. Like when I thought that I had to give up chefing because that wasn't the job that I wanted, I really had to think about how I wanted to be a chef and how I wanted to be as a chef in kitchens. And that's kind of how I had to look at it instead of just giving it up altogether, because this is my life. It's been my life for 20 years. It's my career. It's in my bones at this stage. Working in good and bad kitchens has given me a view on how I want to run my kitchens. And yeah, it does. It becomes very transparent in the end.
You wrote a piece recently about sexism in the industry, and I guess this ties into what we're talking about, the kind of atmosphere you want to create, the respect between colleagues. What has been your experience over the years of elements of like sexism working in kitchens?
When I started first, I didn't really... Sexism wasn't a word that was ever used. Nobody ever talked about it. Nobody ever used that word sexism. It wasn't a thing. If you faced issues where you were picked on for being a woman, you just the whole kind of goal was to just keep working. Don't let it show that it affects you. Don't succumb to it. Don't cry. Don't cry in front of people. You know, you can take it. Don't let them see that you can't take it. And that's like, when I was a commis chef, I came over to London for a little bit first, and there was a kitchen. I used to be so terrified to go in there. I'd go up the alley at the side before I'd work just to get sick before I went in there, because I used to be so terrified I'd mess something up or somebody would say something to me, because they were vicious. Like, people were really vicious back then. But thankfully, I've come out the other side of it, and I don't see that, nor do I tolerate that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And was it because it was particularly macho, you know, misogynistic?
Yeah.
Or was it just, look, this is the way kitchens are, survival of the fittest, get on with it?
Yeah, it was. But if I think for me, what I experienced was, if you're a woman, they'd kind of throw more at you just to kind of get a reaction. And that's because you might have been one woman in a kitchen of 20 men, or at least 10 men anyway. Do you know, it's very rarely I've worked in kitchens, especially when I was a young chef, where you'd have more than two, three women in a kitchen. And a lot of the women that I had worked with were in pastry, and I didn't want to do pastry. I wanted to be stuck in the hot sections. I wanted to be in the grill with the other people to show that, you know, I can do this as well. I'm just as good as ye.
Yeah. How do you enforce that then? How do you really keep an eye on that? I mean, kitchens are frantic places. They are literally hot, you know, hot. You're under pressure. I don't think they'll ever be super relaxed, just because of the relentless pressure, you know, to be on time, to keep things running on time, and to have expertise being demonstrated. You know, how do you manage to keep an eye over what people are saying to each other in the cut and thrust of a busy kitchen, particularly at your level?
Well, first and foremost, when somebody starts, I let them know, quite frankly, that there is a zero tolerance policy for sexism. You know, I can take and give jokes as much as anybody else, but when things are aimed at people personally, it's a very different situation. And if I see something that affects any of my team, I deal with it straight away. You know, a lot of people, especially with chefs, I don't know how it is in any other industry, but you're on the first couple of months, maybe 3 months or even 6 months, it's a probationary period. You know, if something bad happens, you can tell somebody to leave within that period and not have to give notice. So people know that, you know, this is a probationary period. You need to show that you are a good worker and you're a decent person and you're not looking for, I don't know, reactions, and you're not a bully, basically. So, yeah, it's zero tolerance. If I see it, good luck, you're gone. See you later.
Yeah. Is there a tradition of something called pantsed?
I mean, I never even heard of it before. I didn't even know if it was a thing. But yeah, I was pantsed. It's horrendous. Somebody would come up behind you and, like, just pull your pants down, your trousers, and then walk off in the middle of the kitchen. So that happened to me, I'd say, twice. But the second time it happened, I was prepared for it. So I wore tights underneath my trousers in, like, a 25 degree kitchen, because I was anticipating it. Like, people, I won't say it, but they weren't very nice.
yeah.
But yeah, you kind of learn to avoid as well and deal with it. But as you go up through the ranks and you start to have a bit more seniority, you know, if somebody comes at you, I had to learn to kind of give a bite back just as hard, because that's the only way people would leave you alone. I don't know, like, sometimes you'd have to kind of embarrass them more before they get a chance to embarrass you, so they don't do it again. It's a horrible way to work, but it worked for me, and people left me alone, and that's all I wanted, to be left alone and just do my work.
Yeah. And you get the opportunity now, as you say, to create a new way of doing things. And change people's expectations. So if they do leave your kitchen and they go to another kitchen, they have a fair idea of what's acceptable and what's not. And I think there's a lot of people listening who probably work in other industries that maybe are more male dominated, who have put up with this kind of behaviour, or maybe bullying in general, who can really relate to the effect that it can have on you, and are delighted that people like you are changing the way things are done. Tell us about the Murphia list. What is it and why are you on it?
Jesus, I don't know. The Murphia list. I don't know why I'm on it, but they run out of Irish people. So it's a list for top Irish people in hospitality in London. And I was, delighted to be added to it this year. It was a night of networking and just meeting people. But yeah, it was great. I don't know how good of an idea it is throwing 100 Irish people into a free bar, but it was a good night.
I think you're very humble. You know, I don't know whether it's an Irish thing or just you in particular, but you know, your achievements are incredible. You're working in the best restaurants in the world. You're one of our greatest ever chef exports. You're on this Murphia list, which spotlights Irish movers and shakers in London's food and drink scene. And, you know, where does that humility come from, do you think?
Catholic guilt, probably. I don't know. I don't know. I don't, as much as I kind of, my social media is basically just food memes and like human rights, but I don't really tend to big myself up that much because I'm just doing a job like anybody else, and I'm fortunate enough to be in a position that I can help other people coming up through the ranks with advice and, you know, kind of hopefully show them a path of how to be in kitchens and how to be in their job and how not to be, especially.
Yeah.
But it all comes to like respect, and I'm glad that I have an opportunity to do that. But I suppose I am a bit humble about it.
Yeah, yeah. That's not a bad thing. And have you any plans to come back and open a restaurant here, Christine? Because we need restaurants and they're hard to keep open.
If any of your listeners have a spare couple hundred grand they want to throw my direction, I'd love to. But apart from that, I am planning. I'm in the early stages of planning my own restaurant. You know, I love London and the food scene here can't be beaten, but I want to live by the coast again. I lived in Galway for a couple of years and I loved it. And I love the way of working in places like that. I want to have a more of a like eco-sustainable ethos in the running of my own place. You know, zero waste, kind of no single-use plastic, all that kind of stuff. Mm. And like a community hub, I suppose, something that kind of gives back as much as I take. So like working with local farmers and producers, artists, and I used to be involved in a way of working previously that was very much like that. And I think out of every job that I've had, this makes the most sense to me and how I want to work as a restaurateur myself. And to be honest, at this stage, it just kind of feels like a responsibility, especially the way the current climate is.
Worryingly, it appears that parents posting pics of their kids online could be putting themselves and their children at risk of abuse at the hands of cyber criminals. Claire Byrne had the story.
This warning from a leading British cybersecurity expert that just 20 images of a child are needed to create a deep fake version of their identity, including a video, has raised concerns about just how much information parents are sharing about their children. And research showed that people with children under the age of 16 upload an average of 63 images a week. 60% of those pictures are family photographs. Well, I'm joined now in the studio by Mick Moran, who's the CEO of Hotline.ie. I suppose it's no harm for all of us to be reminded of safety and security around posting pictures of children online. But this research, it's from Professor Karsten Maple at the University of Warwick in England, saying that parents are unwittingly opening their children up to possible exploitation by criminals who want to use their data for their own purposes. What are we talking about? What kinds of stuff are we talking about?
Well, you know, modern technology now with AI and everything else and generative models, large language models and multimodal models of AI can be used to use those images to create lifelike images, lifelike movies of your child if they have. And his idea that there's 20 images now, we would have thought, you know, the more information AI has, the better the results at the end of it. He's saying 20. I'm not going to question an academic of his standing. He says 20 images is all is needed. You know, that's eventually going to get down to one image, you know, as AI gets stronger and more.
Are you saying that the thinking before this research came out was that you needed many more or less?
Yeah, but the better the quality of the information going in, the better the quality and information coming out. So they're called large language models because they needed large data sets to ingest before they could give you out and answer you in a human manner. about all, because they, you know, they are ultimately, they're only computer programs that associate, that take what they're given and mix it around, if you like, to give you out what you get.
So what are we worried about when we hear about possible exploitation by criminals?
So for absolutely, you know, the big worry is always that, you know, these AI models will be used to create CSAM, to create sexually explicit images of children and children involved in sex acts. And so the possibility and the danger, I mean, we've already seen in the past images of innocent images that kids themselves are posting or their parents are posting being used, say, for example, in advertising pornography sites. Mm-hmm. We've seen that before. We've had that argument before. In this case, however, giving a certain data set of images, 20 in Professor Carson's case here, he's saying 20 of them, will allow you to produce an unlimited amount in any scenario of that child.
Right.
And that's one aspect of it. I mean, you know, the deepfakes could also be used in fraud or in deception or in scams or in, you know. And then you have to, you know, be aware that your data is being used to train these models, et cetera, et cetera. And fundamentally, any information you share online can be used in ways you never intended. And you need to be aware of that. And therefore, you shouldn't be sharing publicly.
Mm. The other aspect of this, of course, as well, that if your child reaches adulthood, this is just a very basic thing, and they turn to you and they say, why did you share my images when I was a baby and a toddler and a child? On a very basic level, we need to be careful of that, don't we?
We absolutely do. And one of the things, one of the traps within, say, you would imagine that data protection rules would mean that those images couldn't be used. But if you're sharing them publicly, that expectation of privacy is gone. Mm-hmm. And the thing about a tricky thing that the companies do, not all of them, but some of them, is that they see it as implicit consent. So if you're an adult and you share a picture, if a picture of a child is there, they have to be careful of it. It attracts different rules under data protection. However, if you're a parent and you share a picture of your child or another child, it is deemed to be implicit consent from the parent that transfers to the child. And therefore, they can use the image.
For what?
Well, to train large language models, to train other data sets, to train algorithms, all that sort of stuff. They can use the images for all of that sort of thing. It's very unlikely, it's very rare that they'll turn up in an advertisement or that they'll be used in a kind of, you know, publicly open way. But it'll be used as data is now used. And I wouldn't have any fear, say, for example, for the likes of Google or Meta. I wouldn't have any. They're well regulated and they're well watched, especially in relation to data. But it's the shadow brokers. It's the huge amount of, I don't know if you've ever seen, if you've ever gone in to have a look at when you're being asked for your cookie consent. If you go in and look at the, you know, hundreds, 176 partners that they have. These are all data brokers who are buying and selling data about you, about your profile to advertisers, to people trying to make new products, to, you know, it's an infinite amount of uses, and it's not twee to say that data is the new gold. So I mean, it's a commodity.
It is
sold and bought.
It certainly is. But when you are talking about sharing images, you mentioned sharing publicly.
Yes.
Now there'll be people who are members of clubs, and they might be part of a private group on, say, Facebook or Instagram. Is that safe? Is that private?
Absolutely safe. And you know, it's important that this type of discussion, which is a legitimate discussion around nefarious use of images, making CSAM in fraud,
which is
or whatever.
Child sexual abuse material.
Child sexual abuse material, or AKA, also known as child pornography within the law. When you talk about that, it's important that that's not used to panic parents and to say, don't be sharing your pictures of your children online, which I have heard some commentators saying. Mm-hmm. That's not true. Absolutely share your pictures. You know, I have a daughter in Australia. I send pictures, you know, I'm sharing pictures with her all the time. With, you know, we all have people abroad. You know, there is absolutely zero problem with sharing on Facebook or Instagram or anything else, as long as you are limiting who can see it. And you have settings there to do it. And that's, again, we're back to the safety by design. All of that should be turned on by default. But it's not.
You have to go in and do it yourself.
Yeah, you have to go in and do it yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's there's the trap that people are falling
and
in.
And we should include WhatsApp in that because that's encrypted, right? That's
But WhatsApp is not the same, say, as Instagram or because you it's only very recently that you can share publicly on WhatsApp. It's only very recently. So it will become, now that they have communities functionality, what they're doing is they're adding to it and it will, WhatsApp eventually will have your social media will be in there too.
Now, I will have people, I would imagine, well, I'm thinking this, you know, you're in a group, let's say it's a WhatsApp group or it's a Facebook group or whatever, and it's all private, you've have your settings the way they should be.
Yes.
But you're still at risk of your child's image being screenshotted by somebody, aren't you?
Or saved to their device and then shared elsewhere. Yes, of course you are. You absolutely are. And that's just the rules of the group. But it depends on what type of group you're in, you know, as to what expectation of privacy you would have.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, if you're in a group with your pals, it's very unlikely anyone is there. But if you're sharing it in a parenting group or whatever, where you know, parents of many schools are in it, you don't know them all, you don't know them. You know, it's the advice we give to kids all the time. Know the person in real life before you call them a friend online. It's the same thing for adults.
For parents.
Yeah. Be concerned, you know, be considerate of the fact that there could be people who have nefarious purposes in the background who will be maybe saving these images. And if you're sharing a lot of images of your child, well, then there's a nice, cute and boxed off data set that could be used to train a large language AI model to produce more of that child. So the result being, or to mix and match with perhaps some pornography to produce that child's, the child featuring in the pornography.
Are there any laws against that?
Yes, well, like CSAM and child pornography is illegal under the Child Trafficking and Pornography Act of 1998. So it is illegal to possess it, regardless of whether it's made by AI or not. What I'd be calling on the government to do here and the minister here would be to make it illegal to possess or to make an engine or to train an AI engine that will produce CSAM. That's not illegal. So what you put into it, it might be illegal. What comes out of it might be illegal.
But the act of doing it
is not necessarily illegal. So you could have a situation where a computer scientist could create a large language model, which he can then sell, which is capable of producing CSAM, child pornography, but it is not actually, there's none in it.
So, and the computer scientist is not guilty of anything.
Correct.
Because they have built that model. But that would be, and I would imagine, a fairly straightforward piece of legislation to put together.
I mean, our government and all governments right now are ahead at this moment in time. Now, the growth of AI and the AI revolution we're currently living through is exponential. So it's going to be very, very, moving very, very fast. But governments are paying heed to this. How do we ensure that AI is only used for good? And I think this is an easy win, is to make sure that AI can't be used to create CSAM. And most of the big people like ChatGPT, Grok, all of these big AI engines, they won't allow you to create CSAM. But it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that a young fella, computer scientist working in his bedroom, couldn't produce a model and train it to produce CSAM and then make it available for sale. Without him creating any offence.
Just going back to where we started, the 20 images and the creation of the deepfake. Are you seeing deepfakes in your work at Hotline?
We are seeing AI-generated CSAM, yes. And we are very nervous about the potential for it because once these engines start to be used, they're going to produce massive amounts of illegal material. And those massive amounts of illegal material will very quickly overwhelm the resources currently working on it at Hotline, on Garda Síochána, or anywhere else where we're working on it. So it'll be very quickly. And it then will start to appear on the web and on the general regular public internet, out of the dark nets, if you like. And then suddenly now you're creating this environment in which people are being encouraged because, look, it's there. And if it's there, what's wrong with it? What harm can it be? And it's AI generated, so there's no child being abused. But what it is doing is encouraging the abuse of children,
of
essentially.
And you use AI when you're going into schools to talk to children about what can happen, right?
Yes, of course. It's easy. And I did a talk in Boyle, County Roscommon, there for the local community guards and the ISPCC, and we did a talk for parents. And in order to give a demonstration of that, I wanted to say, look, you wouldn't let your child wander out on the street alone. So on my mobile phone, on my smartphone, I produced a 7-second video using Google's AI. It took a minute or two to render, and I produced a picture of a baby walking through traffic.
So you put that in as an AI search?
I put it in as text in a prompt.
Yeah.
Please produce a video of a child walking in traffic and members of the public taking photographs of the child from this sidewalk.
And you got and all I of those got, images.
2 minutes later, I got a movie, a 7-second clip of a very realistic child, wandering through, and I told him to have it holding a toy, and I got a very realistic of a video of a child walking up through the street.
Just thinking about the investigations that we hear about where investigators are trying to trace the victims of child sexual abuse.
Correct.
How difficult is that job going to be now with AI generated images?
Very. And it's going and like I said to you, it's going to flood with red herrings, because we're going to be looking for children that don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of the big models are talking about putting watermarking and things like that so that you'll know they're AI generated, and that's what I'm talking about, of course, is the edge case. This is the extremes, you know, the production of CSAM from a trained model. So it's trained on pictures of the child next door, for example. And then it produces that child next door, realistic, 100% 4K style, high definition videos of that child involved in sex acts. That is the easiest actual thing in the world to do.
Mm-hmm. And the most terrifying.
It is. And it needs action. And it's an easy win, I think, for governments around the world. It's an easy win to just make it very clear to the large companies, you cannot allow CSAM to be produced, which is already done by themselves. They're already self-regulating that themselves.
Yes.
The big ones.
But as you say, smaller ones.
And the fact that these can be made available for sale.
Right. Mick, always good to talk to you.
Great.
Thank you very much. Mick Moran from hotline.ie, and you can go there for more information.
We've been hearing a lot over the last few years about the ever-declining number of bees in the world, but it seems Irish bees are a hardy lot and may actually be bucking the general downward trend facing the species. I'll let Mary Wilson pick up the story on Morning Ireland.
The free-living honeybee is not extinct in the wild as once thought, but surviving in Ireland and in other parts of Europe. And now an international project is being launched to look at how wild honeybee colonies survive and thrive. It's called the Free Bee Project, and it's being led by Irish scientists at the University of Galway. Mick Fispoe is a PhD student involved in the Free Bee Project and beekeeper based in Buncrana in Donegal. He told our reporter Ethna Dodd that he began to get interested in bees when he worked as an organic farmer in Donegal in 2013.
I was looking to increase the yields, and obviously to do that, like, I needed to get more pollinators on site, because 70% of our vegetables, like, are pollinated by bees. So that's where it all started off. And then in 2014, I actually inherited my first two colonies of bees from a friend of mine who passed away. And from there on, it kind of just spiraled out of control.
How many colonies do you have now?
I have nearly 300 at the moment. Pollinators are so important, like, for the human race, because obviously they pollinate so much of our crops. This particular species, like the native Irish honeybee species, like, it's been identified, like, it's absolutely unique to the rest of Europe. So it's locally adapted species, like, and obviously for that reason, like, we should actually protect of our, well, you can call it our heritage. We should actually do our best, like, to protect this species, like, and obviously its habitat as well, because our habitat is, or the habitat for those bees, like, is diminishing year in, year out, where these old trees, like, with cavities in, they keep disappearing out of our landscape.
Now, that was Mick Fispoe. To tell us more, I'm joined by Professor Grace McCormack, who's head of the School of Natural Sciences at the University of Galway and project coordinator of the Free Bee Research Project. Habitats are diminishing, as Mick Fispoe was saying, yet it appears that these wild Irish honeybees are immune, or are showing a certain immunity to the mite that has wiped out colonies of bees worldwide. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, I think on World Bee Day, we need to celebrate what is unique about Ireland and how we do things, and hopefully, as Mick said, protect into the future. In Ireland, we are the last stronghold of this subspecies, the black northern black bee. And yeah, I mean, despite the lack of forestry in Ireland, we seem to be doing something right, that right across Ireland we have free living colonies living in all sorts of places. So they seem to have adapted to the lack of trees by, unfortunately in some cases, but occupying houses, roof spaces and wall spaces. So we have a lot of old buildings and outhouses. And nearly everywhere we look, we find wild living colonies of honeybees.
So needs must, I suppose, and they find shelter where they can. Is it particular counties or is it throughout the country?
It's throughout the country. And I suppose what I didn't say there was the fact that in Ireland, we have much less intensive apiculture than other places in the world. So people often think of honeybees in terms of almost negative for biodiversity because they're these big, massive commercial beekeeping operations, and they have massive losses every year. I mean, like in America this year, they've lost 60 to 70% of all their honeybee colonies. In Ireland, more beekeepers mostly have bees for their own pleasure, and because of our heritage that Mick mentioned, and because they're good for the environment. So our beekeepers, we need to celebrate Irish beekeepers.
Hugely important. Because, tell us briefly about the project and if people can help.
So it would seem that in Ireland, bees have been able to live in the wild because of where we are and the unique situation in Ireland. And so we have people, we work with the National Biodiversity Data Centre. If people look at the wild honeybee study, they can report wild colonies, and then we follow up and we study them. And then we have a population of about 100 people who we call our custodians, and they monitor these wild colonies for us, and they report in their activity multiple times a year. And Mick now is studying. So now we know in Ireland, we're leading the way in Ireland because we have over 700 colonies that we know of right across the country. And now we are looking to see, well, how do they survive?
Well, without the bees, we wouldn't have the Fest of Flora and Fauna on show at the likes of the Chelsea Flower Show. See what I did there? Or, of course, the chance for yet another Irish designer to win big at such a world-renowned event. Audrey Carvel had that good news story on Morning Ireland.
It's a third gold medal for the Chelsea Flower Show in London for Billy Alexander of Kells Bay House and Gardens in County Kerry. Billy heard the news earlier this morning. He's on the line now from Chelsea. Billy, congratulations to you. It's a terrific achievement. Your third gold medal from the Chelsea Flower Show. What did you think when you heard the news?
I was elated, as always. I worked very hard with my head gardener, Greg, for the last 9 days, very hard on the stand. It's a bigger stand than ever before, but when I came in at 7 o'clock this morning to see the gold medal, it was all worthwhile.
Now, tell us about your garden this year. I think it's called Wild Kells Bay. Will you tell us all about it? Describe it for us.
Yeah, so it's wild as in Oscar Wilde, with a huge thanks to my generous sponsors, Wild Apart Hotels, who made the size of my ambition possible this year. So I started Chelsea in 2018, and I started with 30 square metres. This display is four times the size. It's 120 square metres. And I can assure you, I think I had bitten a little bit more than I could chew on Thursday. It was very stressful, but we got there in the end. It's a microcosm of Kells Bay Gardens. I'm standing here in the middle of it in what is called the primeval forest, with a couple of bog pools below me and large tree ferns surrounding me, with a bed of sphagnum moss and woodland ferns all around me.
Well, I mean, I can't wait to see it in terms of what it looks like and read what the judges had to say about it. How big a challenge was it to get it from Ireland to London?
So the logistics are, I suppose I've got more used to them, but they're still very challenging with Brexit paperwork and the costs involved. But I'd also like to say thanks to Hannon Transport, who helped me out, like their expertise in moving plants. So we loaded up a 40-foot 10 days ago in Kerry, in Kells Bay House and Gardens, and it drove straight over to London, arriving 48 hours later. And when we got all the ferns out of the 40-foot in fairly good health, we knew we were looking good for a good display.
Oh, that's brilliant. And what does winning this year, a third gold medal, what does it mean for your work, Billy?
Well, it's very fulfilling. It's a challenge. Like, my friends ask me, why do I go back after I've got a couple of goals already? But it's the challenge. It's a very nice place to come to. There's a great community here with the RHS. They throw on a great show, and it's great meeting the people that appreciate it. And of course, it is good for business. So we hope to see lots of visitors to Kells Bay House and Gardens this summer.
Well, if all that talk of bees and flowers has you thinking of sitting in the sunshine and possibly sampling another summer staple, namely strawberries, now could be the best time to do so. Claire Byrne found out why.
You're at the strawberries for a long time and you haven't seen a year as good.
Yeah, it's over 50 years at them now, Claire, and I suppose this is the best start to a season we've seen in a long, long time. It's probably the best ever, I think, I can remember, you know, that we've had a couple of months of really good weather. And, of course, it suits the strawberries perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
They like the temperatures between 15 and 20, 22 degrees.
And once it goes beyond that 20, 22, does it start to go wrong again?
Yeah, they don't like, any plant really doesn't like temperatures of 26, 27, 28 degrees. So the temperatures at the moment are absolutely brilliant. You know, mm-hmm. The days are between 17, 18 and 20, 21, 22, which is absolutely perfect.
Lovely weather. And what you had an early crop as well this year, didn't you?
Yeah, well, what the fine weather does, like we're in heated glass is our first start. So we are a week earlier with the heated glass. We started on the 25th of March and our heated glass has been picking since. We're nearly completed all the glass now. We have a couple of blocks of heated glass and then a block of cold glass, which I call cold glass is glass that doesn't have any heating in it.
Mm.
And that kind of bridges the gap between that and tunnels.
Jimmy, sometimes...
Yeah, our season is going perfect.
Sometimes you can get strawberries, Jimmy, I don't know if you'd agree with me, and they can taste a bit watery. They can taste like a strawberry, but not like a strawberry that you'd remember from the 80s, say. What you're getting there, what you're describing to us today, that's the real intense strawberry flavour that we remember, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, because if you will remember that when you get into September and October and November, that actual sweetness is gone from the berry itself. And that's because the weather is getting colder and the strawberries are taking longer to ripen, and then you don't have that sweet taste like you have now.
Mm-hmm.
It's as good a taste now as I've ever seen with fruit. And it doesn't matter what variety it is, they all taste beautiful.
Now, my children, when they see a punnet of strawberries, they all go for the big one. But that's not the best thing to do, is it?
Well, no. The reality of life is that the smaller berry can be sweeter than the large berry. The large berry can have more water in it and therefore reduces that taste. The smaller berry is more compact and you have more juice in it rather than water. Mm-hmm. So it's sweeter.
And as you're going through the season then, the berries might be smaller that are coming through. Is that right, when they're on their second or third round?
Once you start off, your first pick or first two or three picks, the fruit is large. And then as the crop advances, after 3 to 4 weeks, the berries get smaller. It's a natural process from any plant. Once you're taking away fruit and it's producing fruit, it gets weaker and the berries get smaller. And it's the last of the crop that you pick has the sweetest fruit.
And is the demand there for all this fruit you're producing?
Yeah, the demand has grown every year at the rate of about 10%. And we are, I suppose, at the moment struggling to keep up with that demand. The imported fruits this year from Egypt and Spain and Morocco and these places wasn't good because they've experienced terrible weather conditions in Spain and in Egypt, and the fruit wasn't good. So the demand this year for our Irish produce is greater than other years because of that, because people weren't enjoying strawberries through the months of November, December and January, you know. They just weren't nice.
Right. Yeah, isn't it great to see the demand there for, you know, our own Irish product that we're growing there, particularly in Wexford, where you are, the home of the strawberry, you know, that we can do it? Because I'm sure you've had years in the past where you were washed out of it, essentially.
Yeah, we've come off the backs of bad years. Like, but, you know, when you get into good weather like this, and after coming through winter, we've had a bad winter. And actually, when you're growing fruit, like, there's probably more work goes on during the winter preparing the crops for the summer.
Yeah.
And people don't realise that. Mm. But you have to get out of the elements and do the work.
And Jimmy, do you eat them yourself?
And not one. Not very many. I'm over 50 years at them, so... Yeah, maybe I ate them too much of them when I was young,
exactly.
But not at the moment.
You're sick of them. Jimmy, thanks.
Absolutely, yeah. I'd eat one or two just to try the taste. But generally what I do is I'd often watch youngsters and they'll be doing the tasting for me and they wouldn't know it. And when I see them eating the berries one after the other, well, then I know I have sweet fruit.
And that's just about it for this edition of Playback Daily. Before I go, a reminder that you can listen back to all of your favourite shows at rte.ie/radio, or you can also get them for 7 days after broadcast. That's on the RTE Radio app. You can also access our podcasts at rte.ie/podcasts, or from whichever is your preferred podcast platform. So happy listening. And from me, Trevor Keegan, bye for now.